What does motion sound like? With Kizik Hands Free Shoes, it sounds a little something like this. Experience the magic of motion. Get a free pair of socks with your first order at kizik.com/socks.
This is your last chance to enter the Ohio Lottery's Fun Turns 50 promotion. Score $3,500 and two tickets to the epic party at the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, where you could win part of another $400,000 in cash prizes. Enter the new 50th anniversary scratch-off, or $50 worth of eligible non-winning $5 or $10 scratch-offs, and My Lotto Rewards through the Ohio Lottery app. Hurry up! The last entry deadline is May 13th. Lottery players are subject to Ohio laws and commission regulations. Play responsibly.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Hello, and welcome to New Books in Philosophy, a podcast channel with the New Books Network. I'm Carrie Figdor, Associate Professor of Philosophy at the University of Iowa. I'm co-host of the channel along with Robert Talese, Alexis McLeod, and Sarah Tyson. Together, we bring you conversations with philosophers about their new books in a wide range of areas of contemporary philosophical inquiry. Today's interview is with James Doyle, lecturer in philosophy at Harvard University. His new book, No Morality, No Self, Anscombe's Radical Skepticism, is just out from Harvard University Press. This is the centennial year of the birth of G.E.M. Anscombe, one of the major philosophical figures of the 20th century within the analytic tradition. A close associate of Wittgenstein, Anscombe contributed fundamental insights in philosophy of mind, action theory, and ethics. In his new book, Doyle considers two of her major papers. In Modern Moral Philosophy, she denies that the term moral picks out a special type of obligation or reason, and argues for reorienting ethics towards understanding concepts of virtue. In the first person, she denies that the term I really is the device of self-reference that it seems to be. Doyle clarifies and assesses her arguments in response to a number of prominent critics, and in doing so, he shows how Anscombe continues to inspire thinking about fundamental issues in ethics, philosophy of language, and philosophy of mind. Let's turn to the interview. Hello, James Doyle. Welcome to New Books in Philosophy.
Hi, very happy to be here.
So I'm really interested in talking about your book on G.E.M. Anscombe, No Morality, No Self. It's an interesting, it's a different book in that it focuses on two of her papers and, sort of defends and clarifies her arguments, responds to certain critics and so forth. So it's a interestingly structured sort of book, somewhat different from what we usually do. But before we get into the articles that you focus on, it'd be good if you could tell us a little bit about yourself and your background as a philosopher, and then how you came to write this book.
My original philosophical interests as a PhD student were actually in political philosophy. But then soon after graduating, my interests began to shift, and they've shifted quite a lot sort of subsequently also. But I became interested more in ethics and the history of ethics and ancient philosophy. And I sort of had realized that it sort of turned out that a lot of the philosophers I particularly admired had a background in Greek philosophy. And I sort of developed a kind of paranoia that they were sort of onto something that I didn't know about. So I sort of trained myself up in ancient philosophy. And partly as a result of coming to understand, as I thought, Anscombe's 1958 paper, Modern Moral Philosophy, better, I started to become more interested in issues in moral psychology and the philosophy of action. That's to say, taking seriously her suggestion that there were questions in those areas of philosophy that needed to be dealt with more satisfactorily before we could even sort of move on to ethics at all. In any case, I've been sort of continuously interested in Anscombe's work, and especially Modern Moral Philosophy, which I first read as an undergraduate. I mentioned in the book I was completely bewildered, but also weirdly kind of fascinated when I first read that as an undergraduate. And the way I came to write the book was, well, it began as two separate articles on those two papers, which then grew in size and became too unwieldy to work as articles. And a further factor was that I was working on them sort of more intensively, actually as a way of procrastinating what was kind of officially my main project, which I've been working on now for about 15 years, which was a book on Plato's Gorgias, which is still unfinished, but I feel like, you know, at least I've got this book out of it. So that was sort of, yeah, that was how it came to be written, really.
Okay, so can you also tell us a bit about Anscombe? I mean, this is 100th anniversary of her birth. She died not that long ago, 2008, I think.
2001, actually.
2001, okay. Yeah. Can you tell us a bit about her? I mean, and her, she was a singular figure. I mean, she was
very much so, yeah. Yeah. Well, she was famously part of a group of women philosophers who sort of came to prominence in Oxford during the war and immediately afterward, which was, I think, not coincidental, because there were very many fewer men around at that time. So, you know, the ways in which the philosophical atmosphere for women might otherwise have been inhibited were not in place. And she, quite early on, even as an undergraduate, I think, became interested in the work of Wittgenstein. And when she had a research fellowship at Cambridge, she attended his lectures and became a sort of disciple of his, and also eventually a close friend. And I think he died in 51, and she was one of his literary executors, and also edited and most importantly translated most of the important works of Wittgenstein's that were published after his death. He only published one short book during his life. The most important of the posthumous publications being the Philosophical Investigations, the first edition of which came out in 1953. So the association with Wittgenstein is important in a number of ways. I mean, certainly Wittgenstein, I think, maybe influenced her at a deeper level than he influenced anyone else, really. But the sort of the downside of it was, as I see it, to a great extent, she was for a very long time thought of as, first and foremost, a disciple of Wittgenstein.
Yeah.
And as time went on after Wittgenstein's death and the influence of the Investigations started to make itself felt, disciples of Wittgenstein acquired something of a reputation for a certain kind of cultishness and dogmatism, in some cases quite well-deserved reputation, I think, none of which I think ever really applied to Anscombe. But I think the resurgence of interest in her has a number of causes, but one aspect of it is a sort of growing realization that she is like very much an important and original philosopher in her own right. I mean, in my view, like definitely one of the like very greatest philosophers of the 20th century in her own right.
Okay, well, these, yeah.
No, sorry, go on.
No, I was just going to say, well, these two papers certainly, you know, are part of that legacy for sure.
Right.
Well, let's you know, talk about the first one that you address is, you know, Modern Moral Philosophy, which was published in 1958. And, you know, the short version is that she thinks that the term moral and what it's supposed to refer to is that, well, that the term is senseless and it doesn't add anything when you say that somebody has a moral reason. It's just, they just have a reason. And if there's some sort of moral wrong, it's just wrong. And so the term itself is just literally senseless. Can you say something about the philosophical context of her argument? I mean, you go into the in the book the link to the rise of consequentialism, and then from there to this the idea that somehow consequentialist moral thinking or ethical thinking made possible things like justifying dropping the atomic bomb on Hiroshima. Right. And so could you say a bit about the context of her, you know, denial of the meaningfulness of morality, of the term morality, I should say.
Right. Yeah. This is bound up with the way in which her paper, I think, was almost universally misunderstood. Most people supposed that her claim was that the vocabulary of morality had made sense when people believed in God, but that divine command was the only legitimate underpinning for it. And so once morality sort of, so to say, went secular, it no longer was sort of legitimate or meaningful. That wasn't her view at all. The view she's actually defending in that paper is that the vocabulary of morality never made sense. What did make sense when people believed in God, or when people thought of ethics in terms of divine command, was a particular what philosophers would refer to as a particular form of practical necessity or modality, which is to say a particular species of the term ought, a certain form of obligation. And this kind of obligation was supposed to be not teleological. That's to say, it wasn't a matter of like needing to do something in order to attain some end or avoid some evil, which was the ancient version of ethical modality that we find in the Greeks. It was rather the form of modality which is associated with keeping promises or contracts and other kinds of convention. And also with the idea of authoritative command, and of course it was a species of the idea of authoritative command. That is, it was supposed to be the case that we ought not to murder people, for example, because we had been authoritatively commanded not to by God originally in the Torah. And so Anscombe's diagnosis of the vocabulary of morality is that in the sort of secular age, beginning around the 17th and 18th centuries, it was an attempt to sort of hang on to that very deeply ingrained non-teleological version of practical necessity, which had been, you know, completely bound up with divine command, but without the idea of divine legislator. And Anscombe's view is that if you take away the idea of a divine legislator, then one is just not really any longer entitled to that species of practical necessity. That the idea of a divine legislator gives the whole kind of point and purpose and meaning of that form of practical necessity. And so without the idea of a divine legislator, the vocabulary just sort of, or the attempt to express that kind of practical necessity just sort of falls to the ground and becomes completely senseless. So that's the sort of genealogical aspect of her diagnosis.
Okay. So it might be good to also step back, because the criticism of morality, of course, is not a criticism of ethics. And of course, for many of us, those are just synonymous, basically.
Right.
So how does she distinguish those?
Well, it has quite a lot in common with the distinction between ethics and morality, which one also finds in Bernard Williams, and especially in his book, Ethics and Limits of Philosophy. So extrapolating somewhat from particular things Anscombe says, ethics is the broader category of which morality is a kind of species or a purported species. And ethics is just sort of any systematic inquiry into sort of what to do or how to live. And that originates in the West with the Greeks, and especially with Socrates. And the Greeks thought of it entirely in terms of the idea of the Greek term is eudaimonia. It's variously translated as happiness or human flourishing or well-being. Excuse me. Mm-hmm. Or something along those lines. And equally central is the concept of virtue, arete, which but the Greeks meant by that term something rather different from the associations that English word now has. And the Greeks just meant a quality of character which was more or less necessary for the attainment of eudaimonia. So that was sort of the original form that ethical inquiry took in the West. Morality is, as I say, a particular purportedly way of thinking about ethics. And that centers on, as I was saying earlier, this very supposedly particular sui generis notion of obligation. And derivatively, consideration, reason, trait of character, etc. But first and foremost, I think it characterizes a species of obligation. And Williams is very good on this in sort of pointing out the ways in which the vocabulary of morality really is structured around this supposedly special notion of obligation. This is something we don't find in the Greeks. Or indeed in philosophy in the Middle Ages, except for the divine command part of morality. So if you look at Aquinas, for example, aside from his obvious emphasis on divine command, he also takes over the entire vocabulary of virtue and eudaimonia as he finds it in Aristotle. But there's no hint of any sort of non-religious version of a special form of obligation or practical necessity. Mm-hmm. It's all just about happiness and character. And so, it's important to see that secular morality is really something very new, considered as a way of doing ethics.
Okay, so to press more on the Greek view of virtue that you mentioned, you call it a egoistic eudaimonistic, as you've just mentioned, as opposed to what you call a Victorian view of virtue.
Right.
Can you explain that different concept that she thinks is not somehow infiltrated by this actually senseless idea of some special category of obligation that you're talking about?
Right. Yeah. I mean, when I say egoistic, this is a bit tricky because I mean egoistic only by contrast with a conception of altruism that's actually distinctive of the ideology of morality. I mean, in a way, I think prior to the ideology of morality, what I'm calling egoistic really just amounted to anything that would count as an intelligible reason. So I think prior to morality, there was a sort of consensus that for anything to count as a reason for doing something, you know, in some sense, one had to be able to make out a case that doing that thing gets the agent something that the agent wants. And that's a sort of ingredient that's more or less explicitly excluded by the idea of morality, because it's often thought of as kind of definitionally contrasted with self-interest. But for the Greeks, for example, then a virtue was not an inherently altruistic notion. The bare concept was just a quality of character necessary for the attainment of eudaimonia. And by and large, when it came to the virtue of justice, there was a general consensus that this involved such dispositions as keeping promises and not murdering people, etc. At least when it came to one's friends and sort of fellow citizens. But the fundamental ground of it was in the interests of the agent. Another way in which this should not be thought of as egoistic in a modern sense is that nothing follows from this conception of virtue about the reasons the agent ought to have in mind at the time they're performing the action. So Aristotle is very good on this. That is, for Aristotle, virtuous action is characterized by a preoccupation with what he calls the noble or the fine. And thoughts of self-interest are not really supposed to be at the forefront, typically, in just actions at all. The connection with the interest of the agent only kind of shows up when we're looking at the very much kind of ground-level philosophical justification of what the agent's fundamental reasons might be for not even so much performing these actions, but rather cultivating these traits of character and therefore becoming, you know, good qua human being, a good specimen of human being. So the whole point, really, of this approach to ethics is to make intelligible the reasons that the agent might have for engaging in, you know, recognizably ethical conduct in a way that the vocabulary of morality leaves seemingly entirely obscure, because morality is contrasted with any recognizable form of so-called self-interest, then immediately becomes a philosophical problem, arguably an intractable one, what reason one might have for acting in conformity with the ideology of morality.
Of morality, yeah. Right. But I suppose, you know, the opposite problem, of course, always arises as well, that if you think of virtues as reasons that one acts in that are in the interest of the agent, right?
Right.
There's, of course, you know, even if one tries to build in this idea of, well, the, you know, a good agent, not morally good, but virtuously good, will keep promises and things like that, it still leaves open the possibility that you could be a perfectly, or at least it seems, you can be perfectly virtuous and not do those sorts of things that we would consider to be altruistic or, you know, other regarding or something like that. How does one avoid that kind of opposite conclusion? I mean, the morality structure has the opposite problem,
right,
where it seems like you don't know how to motivate the individual to, you know, into this, you know, into doing things for others, basically.
Right.
But the virtue, the Greek view, seems to have the exact opposite problem, where there doesn't seem to be any essential motivation to do things for others.
Right. Yeah. No. That's exactly right. And the Greek approach to ethics does face its own versions of skeptical problems. Possibly most vividly and effectively expressed in the character of Callicles in Plato's Gorgias, which also gives us an interesting illustration of the points I've been trying to make about the Greek concept of virtue, because the way Callicles expresses his own skepticism, he wants to draw a distinction between conventional justice, which is the standard understanding on which it involves, you know, not murdering people and keeping promises, etc., and what he calls natural justice, which he wants to say is the true virtue of justice. And that is really only a quality of character that the strong and talented minority can really hope for anyway. And it consists of whatever qualities of character are involved in enabling oneself to dominate other people and expropriate their possessions. But in calling it a virtue of natural justice, Callicles, I think, is being entirely serious. And Socrates never hints at responding by saying, but, you know, that's inconsistent with the concept of virtue. So this is, I think, a very clear illustration of the fact that there's nothing essentially altruistic about the Greek idea of virtue. And as I say, I think you're absolutely right that Callicles does present a very urgent and sort of dangerous skeptical threat to the standard ethical outlook. And so one might wonder, well, you know, in what way then is Greek ethics any better off than the ideology of morality? Right. And that is an interesting question. I mean, my own view would be that the conceptual framework of Greek ethics structured around eudaimonia and virtue, etc., it at least holds out the prospect of making ethical motivation intelligible. That's to say, there is a difficult philosophical challenge there, which, in a way, the entirety of Plato's Republic, for example, is devoted to trying to answer.
Mm-hmm. Not very successful.
Well, arguably. But one might also say, in a way, that Aristotle's Nicomachean Ethics is devoted to the same prospect, mm-hmm. although that in that case it's a more complicated question. But in any case, there is a recognizable philosophical program there such that if it were successfully completed, then we would have an intelligible account of standard understandings of ethical motivation. Whereas with the ideology of morality, it's like there's nothing answering to that. Mm-hmm. It's sort of entirely committed from the start to a type of reason, which has no essential reference to the interests or wants of the agent. And so that seems to be kind of crippled by paradox, so to say, from the very start. Arguably, that there's something kind of overreaching or overplaying one's hand involved in the ideology of morality, right. Whereby there's this kind of very pure conception of altruism, which has a lot to do, I think, with unwittingly secularized ideals taken from Christianity, mm-hmm. Which it's a matter of kind of like, as it were, sort of writing ethical checks that can't philosophically be cashed. Whereas, as I say, with the Greek conception, one is not, at least not conceptually, debarred from propounding an account of intelligible ethical motivation.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
Okay. Well, two questions, but I'll see how we go. So you put her argument in the form of three sort of interlocking theses. The conclusion being that the term moral and anything associated morality and so forth doesn't pick out a special category of obligation, and so we should just get rid of that.
Right.
And then one of the prior claims that you say that she establishes on the way to that conclusion is the idea that, well, if we could do moral philosophy, we would be better off using the virtues anyway, and the virtues in the Greek sense, right?
Right.
But we can't do that because the virtues are, this is basically some sort of character thing, and that's psychology, and we can't really understand that yet.
Right.
And I was just wondering if you might, elaborate on that, why she thinks that we would be able to do moral philosophy if we could do it with the virtues. Are we in a better position now than perhaps in 1958, which was part of the heyday of behaviorism, for one thing?
Right.
Aren't we in a better position now to do virtue ethics in a kind of robustly psychological way?
Yeah. So Anscombe's remarks about our currently lacking an adequate conception of virtue this is in some ways bound up with what I was just talking about. So, I think the reason she thinks this is kind of our only hope if we want to do secular ethics is entirely a matter of what I've just been saying about it offering the only prospect of an intelligible motivation for recognizably ethical conduct. Whereas with the vocabulary of morality, we have a complete illusion, because the form of practical modality that it's trying to invoke simply doesn't make any sense outside the divine command context. So it's sort of virtue ethics or nothing. I mean, in current moral or recent moral philosophy, so-called virtue ethics, which Anscombe's paper is often thought of as having inaugurated a kind of revival of, it's thought of as a particular kind of approach to ethics. And it's, some kind of, as it were, third way between the ideologies of, Kantian absolutism and various forms of consequentialism. The way Anscombe's thinking about it, I think, is that virtue ethics is just ethics. Once we've abandoned the idea of divine command, and even the idea of divine command itself presupposes virtue ethics, because she defines in that paper a law conception of ethics as the view that what's required by virtue is also required by divine law. So it's sort of the only game in town as far as Anscombe is concerned. So getting onto your question about what's needful in philosophy for that approach to ethics to have any prospect of working. Anscombe clearly thinks that this is very much unfinished business from the ancient and medieval periods in philosophy. That even Aristotle, who I think she thought of plausibly as having produced sort of the most sophisticated and kind of highly evolved version of this approach to ethics, did not succeed in really making clear what kind of phenomenon, what kind of psychological structure a virtue really is and how it's related to reasons for action and all the other kind of phenomena that we invoke in our ordinary talk about human psychology. So on Anscombe's view, there are a lot of concepts that belong to our ordinary talk about human psychology, which we sort of invoke every day, which we still don't have any sort of remotely adequate philosophical account of. And a central one would be intention, which she herself, of course, tried to make good on in her, in my view, her most interesting and profound work, her 1957 monograph, Intention. But there's a whole cluster of concepts which need similar kind of working over philosophically, including reason, especially reason for action, pleasure, voluntary versus involuntary, wanting or desiring, and a whole range of what have come to be called propositional attitude terms like hope and fear and so on. Anscombe's view was that these were still like very much in darkness as far as a genuinely philosophical understanding of them was concerned. So you're also asking, are things any different now? I'm inclined to say not much. And, moral philosophy is very much kind of trundled on in the same way as if the what I take to be like the real messages of Anscombe's paper had never been presented. And, there's a huge and ever-increasing literature on moral philosophy that takes the category of the moral completely for granted at a deep level. I think the vast majority of work in ethics, that's true of the vast majority of work in ethics. And I think with respect to philosophy of psychology or philosophy of mind and action, I don't think we're that much better off than we were in 1958.
How about all the work that's being done in, what's called moral psychology?
Right. I mean, no, I don't want to disparage that at all. But it's one thing for there to be really kind of interesting and exciting work going on, and another to be able to say that actual progress has been made. But I think some progress has been made. I mean, I suspect, insofar as I understand it, that the work of Michael Thompson has advanced our understanding to some extent of some of the sort of the foundations of the concepts that get deployed in connection with human action. I also think with respect to the ethical side of things, Philippa Foot's book Natural Goodness was very helpful for me anyway. In understanding the kind of some of the peculiarities of the kind of contours of the any version of the concept of virtue, which is going to be remotely fit for purpose with respect to our current predicament in philosophical ethics. Foote was also part of that generation, one of the women in that generation that I mentioned that came to prominence in the war, and was I think she was also a fellow of the same college as Anscombe in Oxford for a long time, and they were close friends. I think her work's very important in this connection also.
Okay. Perhaps final question on this particular paper, but one of the things you said just a moment ago, and we're talking about the idea of motivation, right? The agent's motivation for doing things. Mm-hmm. I'm just wondering if you could clarify. It seems like there is this. She argues against. At least you say that she doesn't accept any sort of consequentialist view of ethics. Mm-hmm. On the other hand, consequentialism itself is very often sort of criticized, at least in its hedonistic forms, perhaps, as, you know, being entirely selfish, uh-huh. right? Depending entirely on one's own, you know, what's good for me, what's good for my happiness. And so the criticism of consequentialism, there seems to be a tension there between her being a sharp critic of consequentialism and the idea that consequentialists seem to put all the motivation in exactly the right place as far as the Anscombe's virtue theory seems to be.
Right. Yeah. I think I would want to take issue with that as a characterization of consequentialism. That is, I think consequentialism isn't like any philosophical theory, is an attempt to make certain things more intelligible. And indeed, you know, it's an attempt to make the idea of a ethical or so-called moral reason more intelligible. But I think that from the perspective of someone like Anscombe, apart from any other criticism she has of consequentialism, it's sort of doing it, so to speak, in the wrong place. That is, it's trying to make ethical concern intelligible by interpreting it in terms of supposedly better understood ideas like happiness, or happiness really in the case of Mill, I would say, or even pleasure. I mean, Mill said he was talking about pleasure, but really it turned out that he was talking about happiness. But someone like Bentham and also certain more recent utilitarians are happy to talk about it in terms of pleasure. And so the purported increase in intelligibility comes from understanding ethical reasons and ethical concern in terms of ideas which are supposedly better understood and arguably even sort of quasi-scientifically respectable insofar as like pleasure can be thought of as a kind of an empirical psychological phenomenon. Which I would like totally dispute, but like that's what a lot of people think. But when it comes to the issue of egoism versus altruism, my own sense is that most consequentialists and certainly utilitarians tend to sort of assume from the outset, often sort of without even giving it any kind of explicit consideration, that like the moral motivation is simply concern for humanity as a whole, or even like for many utilitarians like Bentham and Peter Singer, with sentient creatures as a whole. And no attention is really paid to the reasons why we're supposed to have that kind of concern, as opposed to a more narrowly circumscribed concern, for example, with our friends and family, let alone with like just oneself. And so again, I think we're seeing here a kind of unconsciously inherited assumption of kind of universal love, so to say, that we get from Christianity. But even in the context of Christianity, I mean, the mainstream ethical tradition in Christianity is in a certain respect secular, because with respect to the strictly ethical commandments, someone like Aquinas thinks that they're overdetermined. That is, that we can also give a kind of Aristotelian virtue type rationale for acting in accordance with justice, etc. But when it comes to universal love, the Christians thought of that as a theological virtue and having to do exclusively with what's revealed. And so it's sort of particularly ironic that ethicists who sort of pride themselves on their secular outlook would unwittingly have taken over from Christianity precisely the aspect that the Christians themselves thought of as not having a secular rationale. And so if you look at Bentham, for example, he takes it as more or less self-evident that, you know, when it comes to an ethical, in his terms, moral outlook, everyone's to count for one and none for more than one, in his expression, which is to say that one should think of one's own interests in with respect to, you know, they're providing reasons for one's own actions as really having no priority over the interests of literally anybody else. You do find, I think, this assumption being made very commonly by consequentialist and particularly utilitarian authors.
Okay. Well, there's more to talk about for that article, but I do want to move on to the second part of the book, which is on the article "The First Person," which came out somewhat later, like 1975. And there, she has another skeptical argument that the term "I," which seems by general consent to refer to oneself when one is using it, is not, in fact, a term used to refer to oneself.
Right.
So can you say something about the philosophical context in which her skeptical argument arises?
Right. Yeah. Let's see. I think this is a thesis of Anscombe's, which actually depends upon a certain kind of seismic shift in philosophical thinking, which in many respects she very much disapproves of. And primarily here I'm thinking about the Cartesian revolution in the understanding of mind, understanding or way of thinking about the mind. Famously a dualistic conception, which is related to introspection in a way that no prior version of dualism, which is essentially a Platonic idea, had really expressed. And this is bound up in complicated ways with what one might call the reception of the scientific revolutions, in which Descartes himself was, of course, as a physicist, a major player. But I'm just talking about that because Anscombe's reasons for denying the first-person pronoun as a referring expression actually have a lot to do with the kind of thought experiment which has really come to prominence as a consequence of the Cartesian way of thinking about mind. And one version one thought experiment of that kind that Anscombe invokes in the first person is the notorious sensory deprivation tank, whereby we're to imagine, or I'm to imagine, that I've been I'm suspended in a sensory deprivation tank with no sensory input, and I'm everywhere sort of locally anaesthetized. I can't gain any sensation of touch of any one part of my body in connection with any other, etc. But Anscombe points out, even in this predicament, I can still obviously have first-person thoughts. In fact, the example she herself gives is, I won't let this happen again. And the point there is Anscombe also wants to argue that if I has a reference, then it must be a referent that one knows to be present at the time one uses the word. But of course, one cannot, well, I say of course, but arguably one cannot in that context, in the relevant sense, know that that one's body is present. One has absolutely no sensory information kind of coming in that might be associated with the reality of one's body. And so if I is a referring expression, then as it occurs in that context, in a thought like, I won't let this happen again, the only item on Anscombe's view that it could possibly refer to would be something very much like a sort of disembodied immaterial substance or Cartesian ego. And Anscombe has like very deeply rooted reasons, largely deriving from Wittgenstein and the Philosophical Investigations, against thinking of human beings as, embodied Cartesian egos. And I think she plausibly sees like a great deal of the sort of the whole thrust of sort of Wittgenstein's philosophy of mind in his later work as being sort of devoted to kind of overthrowing that whole picture of human mentality. And so very briefly, the summary would be that I can't be a referring expression because if it were, it could only refer to a Cartesian ego, and there are no such things. And so if I were a referring expression, we would have to adopt what philosophers would call an error theory about all first-person judgments, because they would all turn out to be false or maybe meaningless in virtue of their central term construed as a referring expression not having a referent.
So if that's the modus tollens, then I mean another approach would be to say that if it were a referring term, is to deny the conditional, right? So if it referred to anything, it would refer to that Cartesian ego, but perhaps there's a way to block that conditional itself, right? Rather than deny what seems to be patently, you know, true or obvious. I don't know. I mean, at least again, I mean, she's arguing against this, but the idea that, you know, well, if there is no such ego, then I must not refer at all.
Right. Yeah. I mean, this has to do with one of the ways in which I think the dialectical situation with respect to this 1975 paper is very different from modern moral philosophy. And you know, my aspirations in the book with respect to the later paper are much less ambitious. I mean, I think you're right that there is, you know, there's clearly a prima facie intelligible case to be made against that conditional, that, you know, if I is a referring expression, the only thing it could possibly refer to would be a Cartesian ego. And in the literature, very many of the people who've taken issue with Anscombe's view here, which is to say pretty much everyone who's written about it, have taken that tack and tried to argue that, no, you know, we can understand I as referring to, you know, the human animal or the human body or something along those lines. And I don't have that much to say by way of reinforcing that particular line of argument of Anscombe's. Much of what I say in the book has to do rather with a different argument she presents near the beginning of the paper against the possibility of I being construed as a device by which the speaker refers to him or herself, which I refer to as the circularity argument. So that is probably too complicated to go into in any detail in this context, but she's essentially arguing with some degree of convincingness, I think, that there is really no way of making out that claim in a non-circular fashion. That is, that the only way of trying to make sense of the very special kind of self-reference which I is supposed to be able to effect, the only way of making it out turns out to presuppose that special kind of self-reference itself. And so I do suspect she's really onto something there, that there is something still highly obscure about the very special character of self-reference that's supposed to be involved with I, because there is supposed to be a certain kind of infallibility involved in that special kind of self-reference. So I might refer to myself, for example, by using the expression Jimmy Doyle, without knowing that I am referring to myself, because I might be amnesiac or whatever. But I doesn't work like that, right? I is supposed to have this very different and special kind of self-referential capacity, such that I can't fail to know I'm referring to myself if I use the expression I. And it's in connection with that aspect of the special status of I that Anscombe launches this argument that the attempts to make sense of it all turn out to be circular. And so in the book, a lot of my point there is that, as I say, much less ambitious than the case of modern moral philosophy, where I'm saying, roughly, Anscombe's been completely misunderstood, and furthermore, when you understand her correctly, she's right. With the first person paper, I'm more saying Anscombe's like issued a very serious challenge here with the circularity argument, and the philosophical community, so to speak, has not really risen to it. And I examine a number of very interesting attempts to meet the challenge by philosophers like Gareth Evans and Lucy O'Brien and Ian Rumford. I argue that for various reasons, they haven't actually met the challenge. And so, you know, Anscombe's challenge still stands. You know, whatever one thinks ultimately about whether we can make sense of the idea of I being a referring expression, any adequate account of that still has unfinished business in the form of answering this challenge that Anscombe issues near the beginning of the paper.
Okay, so could you, you went a little bit into the circularity problem, but could you state it maybe briefly just to clarify exactly what it is?
Right. This might be a bit of a challenge because I haven't thought about this in any detail anywhere near as recently as I have the modern moral philosophy stuff. But the example Anscombe gives is someone, John Smith, who uses the name, I think it's something like John Horatio Algernon Smith or something, which he's reading in a legal document, say a will, which actually refers to himself, but he doesn't realize that in that document, the name is referring to himself. Maybe he doesn't, for some reason, know his own full name, but in any case, the point of the example is that, we can't just rest content with the idea that the word I is a word that any speaker uses to refer to him or herself, because after all, John Horatio Algernon Smith is an expression that John Smith is using to refer to himself. But clearly that's not the same kind of self-reference that we suppose it to be involved with the first person pronoun. Then, of course, there's the obvious rejoinder. When we use the word I, we always know we're referring to ourselves. And Anscombe says, well, but then again, John Smith is aware that the expression John Horatio Algernon Smith is being used by him to refer to John Horatio Algernon Smith, and John Horatio Algernon Smith is in fact himself. So in that sense, he does know that he's using the term to refer to himself. And this is where my own thought starts to get slightly hazy. There is a very standard kind of rejoinder to that deriving from Frege's treatment of what happens to referential expressions in what philosophers call opaque or indirect speech contexts. And Anscombe has a somewhat elaborate argument to show that standard Fregean strategy will not, in fact, work in this context, and that there is still something left unexplained about the use of the word I and the very special kind of mode of self-reference that it affects, which can't be dealt with in that way. And that's where the circularity charge starts to bite. I'm sorry I can't go into more detail with that right now. I should have boned up on that more before.
Well, that's no worries. I mean, I don't have a lot of time left, unfortunately. But I just wanted you actually make an attempt to build on, I guess it's Rumfit, essentially, or mostly, on making sense of I as not referring, as a dummy name,
right,
in some way. Maybe you could, briefly, we don't have a lot of time left, but if you could maybe sketch your proposal.
Yeah, sure. Actually, in the event, I sort of come down on the side of saying eventually that this doesn't look like it has much prospect of success. The idea would be that, in a way, saving the referentiality of I, but by and so it, you know, in a sense, this is a version of the strategy that many of Anscombe's opponents on this view in this debate, the way they've gone, which is to deny that the referent of I would have to be a Cartesian ego. As I said, some people would argue, I think Strawson and McDowell have suggested that No, it's the embodied human animal that could still be construed legitimately as the referent of I. The approach that I'm examining toward the end of the book involves the idea of an abstraction, that is, that we interpret I as making reference to an abstract object, which is essentially constructed on the basis of the purported truth of all the I judgments that we want to say are true. It's sort of the roughly speaking, the idea of the abstraction would be, what we would need to construe is the abstraction to which the word I refers if these judgments are themselves all going to come out as true. And I have to confess that, like, at this part of the book, it very much sort of straining against the limits of my own philosophical competence. And I possibly unwisely there sort of stray to some extent into a very large recent literature on the idea of abstraction, which has actually largely been triggered by a certain program in the philosophy of mathematics, namely an attempted revival of a version of Frege's realist proposals about how to construe arithmetic. And, you know, you can probably already see this is all getting a bit arcane. but I try and look at some of the ideas about abstraction that have been made plausible by various writers on in these areas. And as I say, the verdict I come to is that for various reasons, this does not really look like a very promising solution to the problem of finding a referent for I. It has a lot in common with the arguments of philosophers who are skeptical about the Fragean program in the philosophy of mathematics. And so one critical suggestion there would be that there's a kind of uniqueness problem which isn't solved. That is, if we construe I as referring to an abstraction, there are going to be very, very many possible abstracta which would be sort of candidates for the referent of I, and there would be no principled way of choosing between them. And so for that and various other reasons, my final suggestion is really that this is not going to work as a solution to the problem of finding a referent.
Okay. So I think we are out of time. I'd like to end with a question about where your research is going next. I mean, you said you were working on a different book that you had set aside, or what's your next project?
Right. Well, I'm now working on a number of different projects, more or less simultaneously. The Gorgias book is still in process, but Anscombe-wise, I've been working a lot on the book I mentioned, her 1957 monograph Intention, and I'm hoping to produce a not exactly a commentary, but a book primarily about that book of Anscombe's, perhaps in a similar way in which the book we're talking about is about those two papers. And then the other main thing I'm working on at the moment is, well, there's two other main things, actually. One is a sort of textbook about the history of ethics, of which the kind of the hidden agenda would be to sort of legitimate the account of the history of ethics that's implicit in modern moral philosophy. And then I'm also working on Augustine's Confessions, which is a book I've been teaching quite a lot recently, and I find, like, especially interesting. And so I'd also like to produce a book about that.
Excellent. So, I look forward to hearing about those various projects. And in the meantime, thanks again for agreeing to talk about this particular book, and I wish you luck with your with the future projects as well.
Thanks very much, and thanks for having me. This has been a lot of fun. Thank you.
Great. Bye-bye.
Bye.
You've been listening to my interview with James Doyle, lecturer in philosophy at Harvard University. We've been talking about his new book, No Morality, No Self, Anscombe's Radical Skepticism, which is just out from Harvard University Press. I'm Carrie Figdor. This is New Books in Philosophy. I hope you enjoy the podcast, and thank you for listening.